Hello, everybody, and welcome to Masterclass, August 24th, 2023. So glad to see everybody. We have a good group of presenters this evening. I do have one recording that I will be showing for Zach Ray, who was a past intern, and they couldn't make it in time to go ahead and show you and present it themselves. So I will show you that one. If everyone is ready, I do have the agenda in the chat for this meeting, so you can see what that is. We're going to start with Brooke. And if you're ready, you can go right ahead.
I'm ready. Let me get my screen shared. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Sometimes it's quiet. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So my topic was on smart Band-Aids and the new smart medical equipment that is coming out. And I feel like part of this is that I should give a little bit of background about myself. I work as an OT, which is occupational therapist. I worked in the hospital for around 6 years, and I worked through COVID, and that is around the time that I decided I didn't really want to stay in healthcare anymore, so I signed up to go back to school. And during that time, I was helping the IT team implement a new charting system, and so they were asking me a lot of questions about what I thought we needed for charting, and I was kind of helping them troubleshoot through some things, and I thought, well, this is really interesting. And so that is why I chose to go to IT. I also just feel like a lot of healthcare workers got the COVID burnout, and so I just wanted to try something different. So I have kind of fell in love with IT. A smart bandage, first of all, is it's a like a Band-Aid kind of. It's pretty flexible, but it's a device that can be used to treat wounds that are hard to heal. The smart Band-Aid, it's expected to make itself really known in the next year or so, I would say. A lot of the research that I did, they're using them some, but not a whole lot right now. They're kind of trialing things out. They're using it more to treat chronic wounds rather than like a new wound or something that's superficial. And those wounds are like your diabetic ulcers or bed sores. And it is uses little bioelectronics inside of like a chip, and it's got a little flexible, I would say like a gel type overlay. That way it's kind of waterproof, and what it does is it senses the wound and it gives a feedback to a doctor. And the reason that this is probably going to actually make it is because there's a nursing shortage across the entire United States right now, and they just don't have enough nurses to care for these patients. So they are turning to electronics to do that more and more and more. In the hospital, they use telesitters, and they put this camera in a patient's room, and one nurse can watch four patients all at one time, and she can come over the intercom and talk to them and tell them, you know, don't be getting up by yourself, or okay, I'll come in there in a minute. But it makes it so they don't have to have as many nurses on the floor, because they just don't have them. And that was a little sidetrack there. But so the Band-Aid is made of hydrogel, which is also a material that they put on people after surgeries. So they're already using this. They know that the material works. And a lot of my patients that I see now have the hydrogel dressing on for 4 weeks at a time. It's waterproof. It doesn't unstick unless you really want it to. And they have like the sutures underneath of it just to keep them dry, so people can shower with it on. They can do just about anything really with it on. But there are tiny hollow particles in the Band-Aid, and they're called polymeric and responsive particles, and they are embedded in the Band-Aid. They're capable of sensing and releasing the drugs that are needed. This could be like an antibiotic or like a, what they call like a debrider. Usually it's like a medicine and it takes away all the bad tissue in the wound. And on top of the Band-Aid, there's a small electrical stimulator, and it's used to monitor the wound area, and it monitors for temperature, pH levels, and anything else that the doctors are wanting, like how much antibiotics they're getting into it, or if it is moist, or if they want to take away some of that. And it sends the message back to whatever doctor is monitoring it, so they can get it pulled up on the computer and see what the chip is doing. It also can send out small like electrical pulses, and that promotes circulation, so it kind of makes the wound heal a little bit faster. The circuit board on the inside of the Band-Aid is reusable, so like a nurse could take it off, throw away that hydrogel part, and then put the circuit board back on a new one. And then they could just reuse it. So it kind of cuts down on cost as far as wound care goes. It is also wireless. Some of them use Bluetooth. If the doctors or wound care nurses want to have the information sent to them when anything changes, then they could just have it sent to like a mobile phone or their computer as soon as a change is picked up. And there are small carbon fibers in the sensors, and they are what is picking up the information that the doctors are wanting. And it is completely non-invasive. It just lays over top of the wound. So, as I said before, diabetic ulcers are a big problem in the United States. They affect over a million people every single year, whether it's a small wound or it's one that they've been battling for a long time. I can't see you, or I can't tell you how many times I have, you know, had a patient come in and say, oh, I just stepped on something outside and they're diabetic and it doesn't heal. So then they end up with their toe amputated off, or sometimes their whole leg is taken off. So something like this would help the doctors even monitor a wound from home, so they know if it's getting bad or infected. They can call the patient in and say, you know, we need to start a new antibiotic, or we need to start cleaning this out more, or, you know, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, so we're going to put you in the hospital. But chronic wounds are probably one of the biggest reasons that people are going to the hospital anymore, because they have so many convenient cares, minute clinics. People just walk in and get treated and then come back out. But for something major like a wound that's infected, a lot of people end up in the hospital. And, you know, it would just kind of cut down on the amount of traffic coming in and out of the hospital. I know when COVID was going on, they would tell people, don't go to the hospital because you'll pick up something else while you're at the hospital. So, you know, the hospital's main goals usually are just to keep people out of the hospital. So I feel like this is probably going to take off. Surgical wounds are another thing that it can be used on. People that have like a large surgical wound that probably isn't going to heal, or if they're diabetic that had to have surgery, they could probably benefit from having the smart Band-Aid or the wound care from that. Bed sores is another thing. I know that in the geriatric population, it's a pretty big problem because, again, they're short-staffed after COVID and people aren't getting turned, they're not getting repositioned, and then so they end up with a big sore on their bottom or their heel, and they just are hard to get rid of once you have one. The reason that I think probably smart bandages will take off, or that we need them, is because, like I said, ever since COVID, you can't hardly find medical staff anywhere. I don't know where they all went. Maybe they're, you know, the same thing as me. They're just getting out of it altogether. But this would cut down on the amount of staff that you would need to care for somebody if they can just, you know, have wound care at home. It would also allow for people that are on the list to get into a wound specialist and they are waiting months to get in. Well, by the time you've waited months, your little tiny wound has turned into something that you're going to have surgery to take care of. So if they could put something like this on it, you know, in between that time, it may make it less when they get into the actual wound clinic. And the doctor can check it from anywhere. So, you know, you don't have to go in and see the doctor if you're bedridden, or if you, you know, can't leave your house, or you don't have a ride somewhere. You know, the doctor can monitor the wound from home. It would also save money on wound supplies. I know there's a lot of costs involved in treating wounds. And, you know, staffing is always an issue. Those are my references. And are there any questions?
I think that is just incredible. And it's so great that they have something like that.
Yeah, that especially, was interesting.
Especially for, you know, the diabetic wounds and the skin grafts and stuff. So that's just constantly checked. Emeka, go ahead.
Oh, so the what is the cost implication of this? Are they pretty expensive? I've personally never heard of this before, so I'm a little curious.
I have not heard of it either, and from all my research, it said they're trialing it on people right now, so I would assume it's like a trialing thing, but when it does come out, I would guess that since it's something people can do from home, it won't be nearly as expensive as going to the wound doctor. But I don't know the specific cost on it because it's not, they haven't even like put it out in the public yet. I just saw it one day that they were testing and trialing it, and I thought it was pretty interesting. I'm not sure. Gary, did you have a question?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you meant to be a salesman. Excellent presentation, by the way. I am sold. I was wondering where I can invest.
I don't know. I just thought, you know, for a tiny little chip, like all the things that it can do, I don't know. I feel like It'll probably be out there next year.
Yeah, I'm going to look starting tonight because that's going to be a major, major, major
release. And I can only like imagine the programming that goes into something like that. You know, being able to detect the moisture, the pH, you know, all that, and then send it somewhere. I'm sure there's a lot of like coding and things that go into that.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Such a great idea.
And like I said, in the hospital, they're using like telemonitors because they don't have enough nursing staff. So there's this, you know, they have these little phones that they carry around with them and they can see all their patients no matter where they're at. So technology is definitely creeping in.
Yeah, what's sad is there's no face-to-face, you know, the human factor of it is kind of disappearing because of what we've been through, but having everybody in a more comfortable area, I think, helps too, because you can get somebody on their screen faster than you can get them in, I think is really what works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because I brought my son to get his, for school, he has to get his checkup. And we were there for a good hour and a half before the doctors could take us because two of them went home sick. So there's only two doctors and there's so many kids that need to be seen. And, you know, that's something that can't be, that has to be face to face. They have to do the check that way. There's no way around that. And that's hard when you don't have enough nurses or doctors and stuff like that to come in. So
actually,
that can be done.
Yeah. We had two hospitals here in Terre Haute, and one of them is almost, there's only like two floors left open out of five because they just don't have enough staff to staff the hospital.
Yeah. And I can understand with COVID, nobody wants to go to work doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. I'm going to have to watch this recording because smart bandages, that sounds intriguing.
I know. That is so cool. I mean,
I missed it. Oh,
just
man.
Slap a smart bandage on.
That's right up your alley there, Landon.
I really need this. So I need a smart bandage.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, you have to go back and watch it. It's awesome. All right. Well, excellent job, Brooke. Very much. Thank you. I will pull up the one I have for Zach. Let's see. Let me share. All right. Can you see my screen?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. Let's get started. Hopefully it's loud enough. Let me pull it up a little bit louder.
Cybersecurity in video gaming. Cybersecurity in gaming is very important. The rise of video gaming in this current age and time has made hackers attracted to video gaming. Most gamers are children or young adults, like teenagers, actual children, ages 5 to 10. So their age range basically goes from ages 5 to 75. It just depends on the people. And the rise of hackers mean the increased need of cybersecurity to help with cheaters and hackers and just a bunch of different things. Most modern games now involve an account being linked to the services. And because of this, they can get credit cards, personal information, like where you live at, what state, your address, can get your password and your banking information. And once they have your banking information, they can get your social security. They can basically find out whatever they need to do to find you and to steal your identity. And this is why cybersecurity is becoming more critical in gaming, is because of the accounts that you need to have. And I have a bunch of different accounts because of this. I have a Y2K account, I have a Blizzard account, I have a Steam account, and all of them have my credit card information.
Marjorie, I muted you and it muted the whole thing.
Oh, no wonder.
She had all her email pings coming on, so she wanted me to mute her. And I can't unmute. Yeah, we still can't hear it.
Yep, no sound.
Account. They can do whatever they want with it. They can take money out of
it. Okay, it's back. You'll have to rewind.
Basically, find out whatever they need. Most modern.
How far do you think? All right, let's just go back.
This current age and time has made hackers attracted to video gaming. Most gamers are children or young adults, like teenagers, actual children, ages 5 to 10. So their age range basically goes from ages 5 to 75. It just depends on the people. And the rise of hackers mean the increased need of cybersecurity, to help with cheaters and hackers and just a bunch of different things. Most modern games now involve an account being linked to the services. And because of this, they can get credit cards, personal information, like where you live at, what state, your address, they can get your password and your banking information. And once they have your banking information, they can get your social security. They can basically find out whatever they need to do to find you and to steal your identity. And this is why cybersecurity is becoming more critical in gaming, is because of the accounts that you need to have. And I have a bunch of different accounts because of this. I have a Y2K account, I have a Blizzard account, I have a Steam account, and all of them have my credit card information and personal information, but a lot of them also have multi-authentication, which I use tremendously because it sends a code to your phone that you have to input, which is great. And a lot of places now are doing that, which is awesome in the sense of not a lot of people are figuring out people's account information as easily, or can get into their account as easily, and get these things like your credit card, like your personal information, such as your social, your address, your name, your number, phone number, your address, your whatever, and passwords. Once they get a password, if you're like hundreds of people out in the world, you use the same password for everything you use. Or if they're related, you use the same password for what's related and what's not. It's common. It's more common than what you think it is. And then because they can get your passwords, then they can get into your bank. And this can be your banking routing number, your account number. And once they have your routing and account number, they basically have your account. They can do whatever they want with it. They can take money out of it and stuff. It's not that hard. And so once this are hacked, a lot of people are losing their identity because of it. Attacks that show up in gaming are cheaters. Basically, that is the sale of virtual malicious goods, such as cheats, as products, which help improve game levels and performance. Cyber criminals apply cheats to conceal malicious payloads and links that cause ransomware attacks in the gaming sector. Unexpected players automatically download and install ransomware programs once they open any type of URL. Circ is an example of a ransomware attack in the gaming industry that comes disguised as a cheat hack. It encrypts players' PC files, including videos, images, documents, and deletes them every 2 hours unless a player pays the ransom. That would suck. Basically thinking, oh, this program's going to help me improve my performance on, like, Call of Duty or Fortnite or stuff like that. And because of that, you get a ransomware, and then you have to tell your parents, or you yourself have to pay the ransom to get your account, to get all your stuff back. But that would really suck. Account takeovers, which is another widespread attack that hackers use to steal victims' virtual items, weapons, and other accessories that players purchase for in-game avatars. Account takeover threats is common in lightweight mobile games that hackers achieve through direct messages, phishing attacks. Account takeovers is also a popular in apps that allow in-game purchases. They use third-party payment stuff. Hackers can exploit the payment code and trick players to divulge their credentials and account information to extract financial and personal information or steal in-game items. Malicious actors can then use the stolen information to move laterally into other online accounts or to perform identity theft. This is one of the scary things, because once they get your password, they can get everything, your banking stuff, everything. And once they have your banking stuff, they have your identity, because your bank has your social security number in it. It has your name, your phone number. It has everything for you. And these account takeovers is basically the, hey, here we are, I'm going to do this. And it sucks, because you lose everything. Another thing is DDoS. Most people have already heard of DDoS, but DDoS are attacks that used to hold or manipulate gameplay in a boastful manner to demonstrate power and control over other players. Cyber criminals purchase cloud computing infrastructure to install servers and domain controllers needed to run bots. Threat groups experts develop and assess the quality of malicious programs aimed at causing DDoS attacks to disconnect opponents and gain ranking points. So this is more common in like Fortnite and the whole Battleground stuff, because the more you play, the more people you kill, the higher you finish in the game, the better. And a lot of people do DDoS accounts because they want to get better. Also, this is another thing for account takeovers. Once you do an account takeover, you can get the rankings too, which is part of it. So these are kind of like a hand-in-hand thing. Most people will DDoS someone and then try to take their account. And I mean, that would suck either way, because, you know, you're losing your stuff that you worked hard on doing. Sadly, it happens. It's more common stuff in like PUBG, like Players Unknown Battleground and stuff, for this stuff to happen. It sucks. All the stuff that I'm talking about is something that happens, and you don't think it happens until it happens to you. These are serious things, and this is the reason why gaming and cybersecurity is such a big thing, because if you have one thing that can go wrong in your games, it's these. It's cheaters, it's account takeovers, it's DDoSing, it's malware, it's ransomware, it's social engineering, it's credentialing stuffing. It's a bunch of different things, and it's insane on how much this affects the players on the age range of 5 to 75 to 80. You never know, because they go for the people that are most susceptible, and that's children. Children don't know any better. And once your child gets a gaming stuff, and you have to tell them, hey, these are the risks you're taking right now. You have to sit them down and talk to them, because this stuff sucks. Another thing is malware threats. Games are also prone to malware threats that steal personal information promoted on popular social media platforms such as Telegram, Discord, and YouTube. You know, with Azure, Telegram is a texting app. Discord is also a gaming app that you can talk to friends on, and YouTube everyone knows what YouTube is. Security analysts reveal that Batter was a fast attack that extracted massive data amounts in less than a minute. That's insane. The malware targeted personal details such as players' location, credentials, browsing history, saved credit card information, FTP logins, Bitcoin wallets, and configuration files for various systems services. That's insane. That's scary to think about. Just hacking into a gaming account can get you credit card information from someone's history. Browsing history, knowing what they are looking at is insane. If it's a child on their parents' account, they can get their credit card, their bank account, their Bitcoin stuff if they have it, and files for their computer to basically hack into their accounts and hack into the network and basically mess with everyone else on their network too. And it's basically an insider job just by just hacking into one account. You never think that they could get all this information just by gaming, but it's scary. And most of the attacks happen on children. And you never think that it could happen, but it happens. Another thing is social engineering attacks. This is a common tactic used to target teenage players. This is more for the teenage younger crowd who lack adequate knowledge about online threats. Gamers are active in social communities and have high disposable income, which makes them easy to prey for cyber criminals. So, knowing this is for the younger crowd, like the kids and the teenagers, most gamers do have a high income, a disposable income. That's why they game. That's why I game, because I can't live without gaming. And it sucks when it happens, but it happens. And it's easy. It's easy targets for people because they're like, hey, these people have income. They can just throw away on games. Let's attack them. And that's what happens. Another thing is credential stuffing. Attackers can also deploy gaming accounts used to leak password lists. This threat targets easy-to-crack credentials and player accounts with reused passwords. In this attack, cybercriminals use automated tools to crack user credentials by parsing off possible combinations of characters. The gaming sector recorded 12 billion credential stuffings attacks between November 2017 and March 2019. That's insane. And you don't think that it happens, but it does. It happens more often than not. And 12 billion credential stuffings, all these kind of all go hand in hand with account takeovers. Because once you get your account, they have everything. And it's scary to figure out because we never know what's going to happen. Once they take your account and you don't realize they have your account until it's too late, they have your banking information. And your banking information is hand in hand linked to you as a person, and that has your social security on it. It has all your money that you make on it. And that's just basically a hand-in-hand identity theft field day for people. So now I'm going to get into some examples of these things that have actually happened. So this is the examples that I'm talking about. Let me... the Rockstar tag happened pretty recently, on September 18th, last year. 3 gigabytes of video footage from Rockstar Games Company's GTA 6 edition of Grand Theft Auto series, which has yet to be released, was shared on GTA forum by a user nicknamed T-Poy Uber Hatcher. The attacks claim to have stolen the complete source code for GTA 5 and the early GTA 6 source code. The attackers claim that the videos were from an attack on Rockstar employees' Slack channel. The leak was confirmed by Rockstar, stating that the unauthorized party illegally accessed confidential data from their system. That's insane. That sucks to be a big gaming company and someone leaks your new video game. Another game is the 2K Games attack, which is 2K Games, which is the same parent company that owns Rockstar Games. So this attack, the same week as Rockstar, the attackers gained access to the company's help desk platform and sent malware-infected emails to users. 2K Games have disabled the support portal. It had been verified that the attackers accessed their systems by acquiring unauthorized access to one of the vendor's credentials. That's more on the vendor than the company itself. But that's one way people get in, is by outside sources' credentials. Another attack is the Roblox attack. With over 37 million players, Roblox is one of the world's largest gaming platforms, allowing users to create their games in the company's universe. In July, security researchers discovered 4 gigabytes of Roblox company data had been exposed. Data obtained by Roblox employee through social engineering, which we've talked about on the previous slide, contains emails, spreadsheets on several games, personal information of other Roblox employees and content creators. Unidentified attackers posted some of this data on the dark web. Roblox confirmed that the stolen documents were taken illegally as part of an extortion attempt in which they declined to participate. With someone with 37 million players, that's a big deal. Social engineering happens a lot. And it doesn't get shown enough that it happens. And this attack with all these people's personal information could be, and with it being on the dark web, could be an identity theft ring of some sort. Another attack would be the Bandai Namco attack. Bandai Namco is the publisher for Tekken and Elden Ring. Announced in July, they have been attacked. The ransomware group ALPHV, also known as Black Cat, released Bandai Namco's name on its dark web blog on July 11th. Bandai Namco announced on July 13th that they were the victim of a cyber attack on July 3rd that may have resulted in losing their customers' personal information. That's big for Bandai Namco. They are the biggest gaming company out there because of their games, because they are probably one of the oldest ones too. And for them to get a ransomware attack by the Black Cat is big, because they could lose a lot of money because of the security breach of losing the customer's personal information. Neopets attack happened in July. 60 million Neopet members, registrations, and source codes were listed for sale for 4 BTC, 4 Bitcoins. The Neopet company confirmed that the IT systems were compromised from January 2021 to July 22, exposing 69 million users' accounts and source code. These are users' names, email addresses, usernames, birth dates, gender, IP addresses, Neopet pins, and hashed passwords, as well as data generated during the game, were all compromised. The Neopets, that's pretty big, even though they haven't really been super active, but 69 million user accounts being exposed for that could also be a big deal, because they lost so much information. Like IP addresses, birth dates, gender, names, email addresses, birth dates. Like, that's huge. The last one would be the NVIDIA attack in 22. The Lapis group drew attention with a series of attacks against several technology giants, including the graphic card manufacturer NVIDIA. Lapis claimed that they had stolen 1 terabyte of data from NVIDIA systems. In response to the data, that they asked NVIDIA to open source GPU drivers entirely and remove all restrictions on cryptocurrency miners. On February 23rd, NVIDIA confirmed that they had detected a cyber attack and that the employees' credentials and NVIDIA confidential data had been stolen from their systems. Considering the SockRadar XTI platform database, 38.2 dark web posts related to gaming industry have been reported by the dark web analyst in 22. The most active threat actor is Flower Cower, according to the SockRadar research team's analyst. The distribution of cyber attacks in gaming industry in 2022 by countries is as follows. That is the graph here that you see. And honestly, it's insane. And a lot of people don't understand how big this is. But for gaming attacks, it's pretty bad. It is pretty insane. And that is it for this this presentation on cybersecurity and video games and how important it is for them. My name is Zach Gray, and I want to thank you for watching.
I can find where I'm at. Well, thank you, Zach. Excellent, yes. Good information to know how we might get hacked in gaming, especially. I'm going to have my kids watch that. I didn't know about GTA 6, though. Let me see now. Let's go on to the next person. Find the list. Emeka, are you ready?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, second here. Can everyone see?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, so today I'm going to be going over business continuity and disaster recovery plans. It's a very big topic, so don't worry. I'm not going to go over 15 minutes. Just going to go over the important parts of it. So before we start, just to just go over some rather disturbing statistics here. So Island, a leading VMware-based provider for application hosting, data protection, and disaster recovery services, recently conducted a study where they surveyed 150 technical and business decision makers for organizations across the U.S., each employing a minimum of 500 people. And they discovered that almost two-thirds of that group had suffered an outage within the last 12 months, and half of those within the past 6 months. Additionally, the ratio of outages costing over $100,000 has increased in recent years. Over 60% of failures result in at least $100,000 and total losses, which is up significantly from 39% in 2019. The share of outages that cost upwards of $1 million increased from 11% to 15% over that same period. According to a study by the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Fund Agency, FEMA, 25% of businesses do not reopen after a disaster. Here's another one. 54%, only 54% of organizations have a company-wide comprehensive disaster recovery plan. So these statistics show just one thing. Having a disaster recovery plan is an essential part of maintaining business continuity. As long as nature, malicious actors, and humans cannot be 100% controlled, there's always a reasonable prospect for disaster occurrence. So the concept of business continuity planning is one of those that initially appears to be just expensive, quote unquote, busy work, until you start to quantify the costs of the outage or loss of business. Business crisis can cost an organization a lot of money, ruin their reputation, if you don't have a business continuity plan in place. Customers aren't very forgiving, especially when a crisis is influenced by accidents within the company and other preventable mistakes. Business continuity planning is basically the process covering the creation of a system for preventing and recovering from downtime or loss of business resulting from unforeseen and uncontrollable situations and events. A BCP includes aspects such as continuity and operations plan, crisis communication plan, critical infrastructure plan, and of course the disaster recovery plan, which we're going to be looking at as well. So what is a disaster recovery plan? It is basically an aspect of the business continuity plan. It's a part of it. The DRP is us making sure the short-term plans, policies, and procedures, and getting the tools that we need so we can recover or continue to operate vital IT systems in the event of a disaster. Here we focus on getting the important IT systems up first, the ones that support the critical business functions. As I mentioned, the DRP is a subset of the BCP, so it's very common that in some situations we have the cyber incident response plan as part of it. It doesn't have to be, but most places are starting to sort of just lump them together. I'm not going to digress into that. Anyway, since pretty much any device that we have today is connected to the internet, sort of makes sense that both of them are combined. From the diagram on that slide there, you can see that the BCP is more enterprise-wide. It's non-specific, it's kind of overarching, while DRP is more technology-related and more specific in its and its goals. Okay, my computer is starting to act funny. All right, DRP is iterative in nature, which means it's constantly changing in response to organizational changes, infrastructure change, and even market trends. All these can invoke a change in the disaster recovery plan. So what's the intersection for both the BCP and the DRP? So they both intersect in the type of disasters that invoke them. So from the slide, you can see at, in this case, it's natural disasters, human disasters, as well as environmental disasters, which can sometimes be confused as natural disasters, but they're different. A human disaster could be the result of a malicious attacker or negligent employee that clicks on malware or something like that. Natural disasters could be things like hurricanes, flooding. Environmental disasters are more like power outages or hardware failures, things like that. So we're going to go over the process of creating a BCP and a DRP. They're both the same, basically. So to begin, we start with the project initiation, and this is where we start the project, the official start of the venture. We would identify stakeholders, get proper approval and buy-in from senior management, and then just basically formalize the structure of the project. And then the next step is the scoping step, basically where we clearly define what we're trying to do with this project and what we are not trying to do. In project management terms, that would be basically what is in scope and what is out of scope. And then next we have the business impact analysis, BIA. This is where we identify and prioritize the critical systems and components in our organization. In one organization I worked in, just as an example, we had assigned different tiers to different systems. So there were different tiers, and each tier had a different requirement as far as recovery. So for instance, we had a tier zero, which was the acceptable downtime was 5 minutes, no more. And then tier one was 30 minutes and tier two was 3 hours and so on and so forth. And since we had gone through this prioritization of all the infrastructure into tiers, we're also able to, everyone was basically clear on what needed to be focused on first and, you know, chronologically like that. So after the business impact analysis, as an IT security manager, we would look through the preventative controls we have in place. So, and try to figure out what we want to deploy in the future. This could be us choosing not to issue laptops at all and provide VDI systems instead. If we don't use laptops, people can't lose them. Data can't really get lost in the possession of users. We could also choose to not build our data center in an area that's prone to flooding, even though it's geographically convenient to main offices. By doing something or not doing something, we're basically preventing whatever from happening. After that, we look at recovery strategies. How do we recover efficiently? Do we have a redundant disaster recovery site? Do we have a cold site? Is it a warm site, hot site? What do we have? What can we do to recover both in a timely and financially viable way? So the ultimate objective is to implement the right recovery strategy that strikes that perfect balance between impact and cost. And I'm going to keep saying this, but I can't help it. But as an IT security manager, your job is also to ask that 3-year-old asking that question, well, what if this happens? Well, what if this happens? You know, you're trying to basically cover as much base as you can with regards to that. And then we move to designing and developing the plans. And these are the specific recovery plans, the procedures, guidelines for our teams and the tools that they need for disaster, for the each disaster scenario. And this is all the practical stuff. There's more the technical stuff. And then next we have implementation, training, and testing. So with implementation, we fix certain things. Our technical point of contact information is updated, you know, things like that. Is everyone involved familiar with the call tree? The call tree is basically the notification chain that decides who calls who, because you don't want one person calling too many people for notification. So you have everything set up, everything's already known. So that's where we sort of go over that. And then with training, we basically make sure that our staff is ready to handle the actual incident. Testing is exactly what it implies. We test the viability and efficiency of the process, drills, test runs, things like that. And then the last step is maintenance. And this is where we basically revert back to the initiation. In most large organizations, there's a lot of constant change. We have changes in environment. We have changes to the systems. We might have infrastructure changes, changes in leadership. Whenever we have new changes like that, they need to be incorporated into the plan immediately. As with everything else we do, we need buy-in from senior management for business continuity and disaster recovery plans as well. So senior leadership needs to be on board from the beginning. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're part of the whole process, but we do need them for initiation where they, you know, with the assistance of stakeholders, define the scope. And then we also need them in the end where they need to approve the plan. And they need to know that they are responsible for this plan, too. They own it. So they're ultimately liable. And then we and the other stakeholders are there to ensure that the plan is complete and effective. So as an example, let's look at a few solutions that could be implemented by way of a disaster recovery plan, just to ensure optimal operational uptime. So we have different solutions that we could adopt. First one is a redundant site, which is like a complete identical site to the production site. It has identical HVAC, generators, power. Everything's the same. It's designed, for services to fail over in the event of a disaster. It's usually geographically far from the active site, and it's also fully staffed. It's the most efficient solution, but also the most expensive. And then we have the hot site, which is similar to the redundant site, but it only houses critical applications and systems. Failover is usually manual. The full switch over takes no more than an hour. It has near real-time copies of data too, so it's not exactly the same, but it's pretty close. And then we have the warm site, which is similar to the hot site, but without real-time data. So data will need to be restored via backups once that site is invoked. And failover usually takes anywhere from 4 to 24 hours. The cold site is a smaller, but still a full data center with redundant UPSs, HVACs, generators, all that. There are no racked servers or data at the site. So it basically has the bones, but doesn't have any of the operational tools that you need. So when this site is activated, the systems will need to be configured and then deployed and data restored and all that. So this is the least expensive option, but recovery may take weeks. Then we also have a reciprocal agreement site, and this is when an agreement is made with another organization whereby they lease space in their data center to another organization for disaster recovery purposes. The network is siloed off and the data will need to be restored from backups when invoked. A lot of organizations are moving away from this for obvious reasons. And then we also have the mobile site. This is basically a data center on wheels, usually a container or a trailer, has built-in fire suppression, HVAC, all that. This is not too popular, but it's an option regardless. And then lastly, we have the subscription or cloud site. And this is quickly becoming the more popular alternative due to predictable costs and lack of requirement for staffing, things like that. A cloud services provider such as AWS or Microsoft basically paid to maintain a minimal or full replica site to the production site. And there's obviously agreed upon service level agreements and things like that. So this is becoming what most organizations are moving in this direction. So okay, so basically just to summarize, the BCP and DRP in particular are essential in the sustained continuation of IT product operations for any organization. I've seen an instance where a DRP is created and then sort of filed away for years without revisiting its viability, only for a disaster to occur. It's pulled out and dusted off, and then contact numbers are not valid. System doesn't even resemble what it was initially. The network gear specs have changed. Even the telecommunications infrastructure was different. I mean, they'd moved away from Avaya to Cisco systems, VoIP systems. So totally defeats the purpose, and it can have severe organizational implications. I mean, it needs to be, the DRP and BCP needs to be continuously tweaked and tested and kept updated almost in real time if possible. Finally, there are several frameworks that can help in creating these plans. Most popularly is the NIST Special Publication 800-34, which is also known as the Contingency Planning Guide for Federal IT Systems. This one's really popular. A lot of people use it, even the government. And we also have the ISO 22301 and ISO 27031, which is pretty popular as well. Basically, just outlines business continuity plans and suggestions, pretty well tested and reviewed suggestions to keep that updated. Lastly, I found one called the Business Continuity Institute. It's never heard of it before, but I came across it. It's basically contains six steps to good practice guidelines. So it's sort of like an independent body of knowledge for business continuity. So I looked through it, and it's pretty good, especially for small to medium businesses. So, and these are my references. And that's it for me. Does anyone have any questions?
Excellent job. It doesn't look like there's any questions. So I have to say, you are hired to do this for the internship. We've literally been trying to get a BCP done for like 5 years now. It just never gets finished. If you're willing, it's actually, it's not so much a business continuity plan. Well, I mean, it is, but it's also a disaster recovery is the biggest thing.
Right. Obviously, the scope is important. You know, is it just for the internship, or is what? I mean, we can talk about it all.
Yeah, it's just for the internship, basically. So, because we did have a disaster once, we had someone who actually deleted our server. Now, we weren't in the systems that we are now. It was another one. And we should have moved him out of the server, you know, beforehand. They graduated and they were not happy with us and deleted our servers. And Doc was in Paris. I was in Cocoa Beach, and she was seeing all the messages coming through. I was seeing all the messages coming through, and we were like, oh my gosh, what is happening? Luckily, we had enough backup and everything settled for it, that we were able to, you know, at least bring up 90% of it. We did have to kind of restart in certain places, but nobody knew who to contact or, you know, who to get to. And we didn't know. Well, everyone else didn't. There was no discovery plan created for them to know what to do while we were away, in other words. So that's something we need to be built up to, you know, if something happens, who's the last resort? Who needs to take care of it? Who's got access to be able to, you know, help us out? So that is something that we would have to talk about.
It is a nightmare. And I will say that a lot of times when you go through and you create this, it actually helps you audit your system too, because you could start asking questions like, okay, why does this person need this access?
Yeah.
You know, you have to update the ACL and make sure people have just the access they need, least.
And that's the problem, because I don't know enough about AWS to go ahead and know if I'm giving them too much access or just enough, or, you know, so I give them access and then quickly once they graduate, I take them out. So I don't know how it works. It's AWS itself. There is someone who can help us, the one who created everything for us, but that would be that person. We would just have to mark that down. But yes, it'd be great to talk to you about that and get more information to be able to do that, especially disaster recovery.
Sounds good.
Great job. Fantastic.
I'm gonna stop sharing here real quick. Okay.
All right, Adam, are you ready?
Hey, as ready as I'll ever be.
All righty, sounds good.
Get this ready. All right, can everyone see?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so I'll jump right into it. My name is Adam. I'm going to talk a little bit about the effects of technology on sleep, why sleep is so important, and how we can kind of change our nighttime routine to hopefully get a better rest at night and be more awake in the next morning. So just starting, why is sleep so important? Sleep is pretty essential for living healthy lives. It helps with our cardiovascular health. It helps with our moods throughout the day. It also helps to improve our mental health by making it easier for us to learn and retain information and also pay attention. And it can also help with feelings of depression and anxiety. So that also goes in with our mental health. And the National Sleep Foundation recommends that adults get around 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And this is typically higher for children, younger ages, close to around 10 to 14 hours a night. But unsurprisingly, 32.5% of adults fail to reach that recommendation. And a staggering 74.6% of high schoolers also fail to reach that 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And, you know, like I said, that can lead to elevated risk of anxiety and depression, as well as other potential health factors when not dealt with. So the effects of sleep deprivation, it can lead to a lot of effects, but these are some of the ones that I thought would be interesting to highlight. So for starters, it can lead to increased risk of different health diseases, higher blood pressure, even diabetes, and risk of stroke. And just because you're not sleeping well at night or getting your 7 to 9 hours doesn't mean you're automatically going to get one of these. But typically people that already have pre-existing diabetes or high blood pressure should get more rest at night because of the increased risk to make it worse. And so sleep deprivation, like I mentioned earlier, it can also lead to more mental health issues, including higher chances of depression and anxiety. And it's kind of a catch-22, though, because people that tend to have higher levels of depression or anxiety don't sleep very well at night. So, you know, it's kind of that back and forth. Those people really should focus on getting a good night's rest, which will in turn help with that. Don't worry, though. Most people at some point in their lives will have sleep deprivation. It's very, very common. You know, about everybody goes through it. Around 50 to 70 million Americans every year are sleep deprived. But a lot of these potential effects only happen in the long term. So if short term, you know, maybe a week you're not sleeping well, it doesn't mean you're suddenly going to have a stroke or get diabetes. So what are some of technology's negative effects? Interactive use of social media, scrolling through social media, texting, emailing, playing video games right before bed, it can lead to, you know, overstimulation, and result in it becoming very difficult to fall asleep, and also just wake up in the morning and feel rested. And of course that can cause, you know, individuals to become less alert, less prepared for work or school. And depending on your job, that could be dangerous, and you could also start to see your grades slip at school. And blue light is emitted from technology such as phones, tablets, your computer screen right now. And this actually can cause the production of the hormone called melatonin to become suppressed. And melatonin is really important in aiding and in inducing sleepiness in individuals in the evening. So when that doesn't release, individuals begin to stay up later. They begin to sleep less than normal and not meet that 7 to 9 hours. And in turn, this also affects the internal body clock and it becomes delayed. You may start waking up later. You may, you know, not get enough sleep at all. But of course, there are some positive effects and some upside to all of this. So for starters, technology such as wearables, items like Fitbits and Apple Watches, which have become more and more popular over the years, as well as nearables, which tend to sit on your nightstand or close by. Both of these items help to monitor your sleeping habits and provide us with a lot of data we can act upon. This includes information like the time you were asleep, changes in your breathing habits, your sleep habits at night, and then the time spent in light, heavy, and REM sleep. And this, some of the information that is collected isn't always as accurate as getting a sleep study done. So some of it take with a grain of salt, especially the light, heavy, and REM sleep. I have read that that isn't as accurate as doing a full sleep study. But using this information, it can really help us get a decent idea as to how we sleep at night, and then we can use it as an opportunity to change any stimuli that may be affecting our sleep, so we can hopefully get a better rest and, you know, do well the next day. A little example, the Fitbit Sleep Database Center in 2017 highlighted that the average user was spending around 6 hours and 38 minutes asleep every night. And so that's just barely missing that 7 hours minimum that we need to rest every night. And it was actually finding that most of the individuals that were older we're actually getting a little less than this, around 6.5 hours. So all right, so there are routine suggestions that you can do at night, and it's very subjective. It's got to be what works for you, but these are some of the ones that I found that work for me and that I read in different articles. So yeah, the for starters, just creating a pre-bedtime routine or activity could be really, really good for you. This could include all sorts of things, yoga, reading a book, meditation, listening to music is even one, as long as you're not also scrolling through your phone, and not listening to music that is overstimulating. No matter what, the routine should be something that is relaxing to you and that kind of helps you to wind down. Next, try and avoid using electronics in the bed. This can make you start to think of your bed as more than just sleep. So sitting on your computer, watching TV, whatever it may be, if you're doing that in bed, it can cause overstimulation and you'll just have a more difficult time falling asleep at night. Another recommendation could include not using electronics, specifically those interactive ones like scrolling through Facebook, playing video games, for around 30 to 60 minutes before going to sleep. I did read a couple places that this could be as long as 90 minutes before you go to sleep. And this is just to help make sure that melatonin is being released. And that you're not overstimulated, you start to wind down in the evening. And finally, many devices nowadays allow for users to mute notifications on their phone, and this is typically found through a do not disturb setting or button on your phone, tablet, computer. And this can be set for certain times. So if you typically go to bed at 11 o'clock, it may be good to mute your notifications for 10 or 10:30. And this can also just kind of help to resist the urge to check on things that ultimately can probably wait till the next day. So why did I choose this topic? In college, in my undergraduate studies, I didn't always get the best amount of sleep. It was close to probably 5 hours if I was lucky, and this was affecting my my studies. I wasn't doing as well as I knew I could, and I was becoming upset with that. And a lot of this was just due to me studying late, being on the computer watching. You know, Netflix with friends or something, looking through social media, all of those things that affected how I was doing and sleeping. But I ended up getting a Fitbit tracker, and I started to kind of watch my sleep, my habits, started to understand better how I was sleeping. And this led to my studies began to improve, my mood became better. And I was just overall more happy and positive about my situation. So finally, just to highlight a couple important points. Sleep is crucial to promoting a healthier life, improving our moods, and just helping with our mental health. Overstimulating technology isn't a great thing to be actively doing late at night, as it can, you know, affect our melatonin levels through blue light and also delay our internal body clocks, making it more difficult for us to get a full night's sleep and wake up in the morning. But technology like the wearable and nearable devices can gather data and, you know, help us to act and improve upon our sleep. So if If you have that wearable technology, try and take advantage of its benefits if you aren't already. And then just create a routine and stick with it. Mute your notifications, do yoga in the evening or read a book, wind down some, and try to improve your sleep, because we're all going through this internship together, but if half of us are asleep most of the time, we're never going to get anything done. So yeah, these are some of my references. And thank you for listening to me and giving me an opportunity to share this with you.
Yeah, thank you. That was awesome. Marjorie and I have sleep problems. Yeah. So we're like, yes.
We're pretty bad at this.
Yeah, I regrettably still do sometimes too. But I've gotten better, thankfully.
So what if you just can't or not able to pull away from the work you have to do? You want to go to bed, you know you're tired, and you just can't do it. I mean,
yeah, that's a problem I have quite a bit. Even just like running through situations that happened during the day. I have started doing like some breathing techniques just to try to relax and start to wind down. And they have helped sometimes. Some other times not so much.
Right.
But I know even therapy can help with some people if it's something that is, a constant in your life that you just need to talk about, even if it's just work. But it's just, I guess, finding those couple things that work for you, and just trying to stay on top of doing that every night, keep that routine, because only doing it for like a week, you're not going to get results. You got to do it for, a year's time, and then you might start feeling like, oh, wow, I'm sleeping better.
That's true. That sounds good.
Yeah, I will try these. Neither, Brooke.
I mean, I'm one of those that also, I need some sound to go to sleep. So sometimes I'll put on like Netflix, and those have the, it's like you hear birds and it's a little lake, it's just real quiet. There's no music or anything, but it's just like I'm outside sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's, the ambient. Thank you. And it's just like so good. If I can turn that on before I fall asleep watching something else,
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I have YouTube. I have one that's just like a thunderstorm that I'll play. Or I have podcasts that are people reading books that are black screen. I also wear an eye mask because I'm very sensitive to the light.
Those are all things definitely could help.
But yeah, I shared a podcast that I found helpful about sleep in the chat. What this sleep doctor says is that, depending on your chronotype, do you know what chronotypes are? It's whether you're a night owl or early bird.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter when you go to bed. You just need to have those 7 to 9 hours because you need to get into your deep sleep to reset all the cells, in your body. So when you fall asleep, you have to stay asleep, and that's another problem of mine, not only falling asleep but staying asleep.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, so
makes a difference. Well, let me say, excellent job, everybody. Thank you so much for all your information. I think we can go ahead and cut it here. It's almost 10:30, so I won't hold anybody any longer. Great job. And thank you so much for your dedication and the work that you've done making the presentations. They're excellent. And let me tell you, I get a lot of feedback on how excellent this is from instructors, from people on the higher ups of the university as well. So they're really liking this stuff. Masterclass is a winner. So great job, everybody. Have a good rest of the evening, and we will see you next week.
Good night, everyone. Great job, all presenters, as usual. Great job.
Good evening, everybody.